Good morning, Tantri, Dato, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. First, I want to begin by saying it's a great pleasure to be here at ISIS. I was here almost 20 years ago on the staff of ISIS. So it's a real pleasure to be back. And I want to thank Dato Mohani for this opportunity. She's been very kind. I've been here for the last week or so and hope to be here for another week. As she mentioned, I'm working on a book right now, which is basically an effort to explain international relations from a slightly different perspective. Usually in IR, people focus on the distribution of power or institutions, on norms, system level attributes to explain outcomes in international relations. The book I'm working on seeks to do this basically by focusing on the process of state making. The argument is that state making drives international relations, has driven international relations in Asia since 1945. Outcomes like war, peace, cooperation and order in Asia and more generally in other regions as well can be explained quite successfully by focusing on the variable of state making. But I'm not going to make this in theoretical presentation, but I just wanted to give you a glimpse in terms of what I'm working on at this point in time. The topic that's assigned to me today is 21st century Asia, is conflict inevitable? The term conflict is somewhat ambiguous. It could mean many different things. So I'm basically going to focus on the prospects for war and peace in Asia in the coming 2 to 3 decades. Why this topic? There is a body of influential scholars who have long argued that Asia was and is headed for instability and war. In the 1980s, a large number of scholars, fairly influential scholars, mostly in the West, but not limited to the West, advanced a number of reasons why Asia is headed for instability. One was the increasing wealth, power, which would be translated into military modernization and rivalry, leading to instability. And Richard Betts of Columbia University was a key proponent of this line of argument. Second was the historical animosities in Asia between China and Japan, and Japan and Korea, India and Pakistan, and China and Vietnam. And these historical animosities were seen as unbridgeable and as factors that could drive this region toward war. The third reason advanced was lack of institutions. Of course, today we have an alphabet soup of institutions in the region, but going back to the 80s, there were very few institutions, regional organizations in Asia. And so the comparison was made with Europe, arguing that in Europe they've been able to overcome through this dense network of institutions, and Asia did not have institutions to alter the role of force or to restrain the role of force. And then, of course, people cited the many security challenges in the region. We are all very familiar with the conflicts on the Korean Peninsula, the conflict across the Taiwan Straits, the conflict between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, and other tensions and conflicts in the region. So these were cited as possible reasons as to why states would go to war. And finally, of course, the citation was the military modernization that was taking place in the region, the double-digit expenditure and a lot of... So this combination was seen as driving Asia towards instability and possibly war. This argument has had a steady support in the scholarly community and also in some ways in the policy community, and this argument has continued. More recently, I think John Mearsheimer, who is leading offensive realists, has argued that the rise of China is going to lead to instability and war. And likewise, most recently, I think a prominent Australian analyst, Hugh White, Scott, in his book on the power shift, has also posited that the rise of China makes war more thinkable in Asia. The basic thrust of all these arguments, the underlying assumptions, is that dominant power will try to restrain, check and restrain rising powers, that at some point the rising power will seek to challenge the dominant power, and this would lead to instability and war among the great powers with system-wide consequences. This is basically the theory of hegemonic war, which was advanced by Robert Gilpin some time ago, and others. And there are similar arguments. For example, I mean, the power transition theory also argues that the change in the distribution of power, especially between a rising and dominant power, will lead to war and instability. And the long cycle theory of war also argues a similar proposition. I don't go into this in much detail, but just to point out that my argument is that war and peace in Asia since 1945 have not been determined by the distribution of power, but by the process of state making. Although Asia does face major challenges, and there may be occasional military clashes and minor wars, but I would argue that the prospects for a major war between states with systemic consequences are highly unlikely, not very likely. And I'll explain why I advance this argument. I will not couch it very much in conceptual terms, but I think briefly I will mention, I think it is a refutation of the power analysis. But let me first begin by exploring the contours of 21st century Asia. What does one mean, or at least from my interpretation of 21st century Asia? I do not subscribe to the tyranny of history or geography, but believe that a good understanding of the past and the present is essential when we want to look at the future. Therefore, I begin by exploring how Asia has changed over the last 60 years, and here I advance three very basic propositions. First, Asia has traveled from being a subordinate region in the world to a region dominant system. This is important. From 1945 through the mid-1970s, the structure and dynamics of international politics in Asia was largely determined by powers outside Asia. The Cold War, the struggle between the U.S. and the Soviet Union had a dramatic impact in the scene within Asia. Asian countries were basically weak as states and powers. They were vulnerable to domestic and international conflict. Nearly all of them aligned with one or the other. There was a strong non-aligned movement, but key players in those movements, in fact, took sides very quickly. Today, the role of external powers in the region has declined dramatically, although not completely. The political and security dynamics of the region are driven by the interests and interactions of states in the region. The dynamics of the long-running conflicts in Asia, for example, across the Taiwan Straits or on the Korean Peninsula or between over Kashmir, they are largely local and regional. It is important to observe, I think, at this point that the United States, which has always been a Pacific power, has increasingly become an integral part of the Asian security region. Some would consider it as an out-of-region power, but for all intents and purposes, in my analysis, I consider the United States as part of the Asian security region. A second basic proposition is that Asia has been transformed from an impoverished and war-prone region to a more peaceful, stable, and prosperous region. Asia has enjoyed relative peace, stability, and prosperity for over three decades. This is a remarkable transformation and achievement by any standard. As I'll show later, Asia was highly conflict-ridden in the first 3 to 4 decades after World War II. Many countries in the region, including South Korea and Taiwan, were described by the World Bank as basket cases that had little prospects for economic growth and development. Southeast Asia was described as the Balkans of Asia. India and Indonesia were seen as unlikely to hold together as a state. They were seen as candidates for a breakup. With the fall of South Vietnam, the dominant theory that was invoked in the 1950s and 60s predicted that the rest of Southeast Asia would fall to communist rule. plenty of all these things did not happen. By 2005, in fact, East Asia and India accounted for 22% of the world GDP, applied to US dollars, and 25% in terms of PPP. The forecast of the EIU is that by 2020, Asia's share of global GDP will be 40%. There are, of course, numerous projections and estimates vary. But overall, the projection is that Asia's weight in the global GDP will increase. And Asia also accounts for a significant share of world trade, capital flows, FDI, foreign exchange holdings, and energy consumption. Asian countries have become significant players in the regional and global economies. Economic problems at these levels cannot be addressed without the participation of Asian countries, and this is reflected in the ongoing effort to increase the voting weight and participation in institutions of global economic governance. The primary drivers of this transformation have been, in my view, advances in state-making, which is very central, and second is a strong economic growth, which has further strengthened states. I should observe here that state strengthening is not a linear process. There have been movement forward, but there have also been reversals. But I think state making and state formation, state strengthening have been very crucial in this transformation that has taken place in Asia. Third basic proposition in terms of how far we've come or where we are today, Asia's strategic environment has become more complex, and it's now much closer to the complex interdependence model than the simple zero-sum geopolitical model that dominated thinking during the Cold War era. During the Cold War, there was little economic and socio-cultural interaction across the ideological and military divide. Today, potential competitors like the U.S. and China, China and India, Japan and China, are also strong trading and investment partners with high levels of economic interdependence. All have prospered to participation in the global free market economy. Although there are several pressure points, including protectionist tendencies in some countries, particularly in the West, transformation or breakdown of the global economy is not in prospect. Analysts who present a stark choice, for example, like Hugh White, who say that there has to be a choice between the United States and China, do not seem to appreciate the complex strategic environment. The analysis and recommendations seem more suited for a Cold War-type geopolitical environment. But the challenge today, in my view, is to reap the benefits of complexity, not to present simple choices that may be attractive but not grounded in reality. And Japan, South Korea, India, and indeed the United States and China all seek to develop complex and at times conflicting bilateral and multilateral relationships across different domains. So basically, I think if you look at Asia from 45 to now, the three main points are: one is the traveling from subordinate to a region dominant system. Second is the transformation from an impoverished and war-prone region to a stable, prosperous region. And third is the complex environment that characterizes Asia, contemporary Asia. And looking forward, again, still with the 21st century Asia part of the topic, I advance four broad propositions, and I'll be very brief here. First, although there are challenges and there may be setbacks, on balance, Asia's economic growth and weight in international affairs will continue to increase in a globalized world. Now, I want to emphasize the globalized world. I'm not anticipating a Pax Asiana or a Pax Finica, but increased centrality of Asian countries in world affairs. Second, I think the increasing weight of Asian powers will make for a relative decline in U.S. power and influence in the region and the world at large. But I do not see this as a quick development. I see this over a number of years. But I mind you again, for the next 2 to 3 decades, the U.S. will continue to be the premier global power and likely to play the lead role in managing global affairs. That role, however, will increasingly be contingent upon support from other major powers in the system. The distribution of power will alter gradually, but the international system is unlikely to become genuinely bipolar or multipolar in the next decade or two. In the foreseeable future, I think we will see features of hegemony, features of bipolarity and multipolarity. Which specific distribution of power applies and how important it is, I think, will vary by issue and location. The third point as we look forward is, I think the dominant dynamic of the system affecting Asia will be the Sino-American interaction. I think that will be the dominant dynamic in politics, security, and economics. again, here, I think the salience of this dynamic will vary by issue and location. Other dynamics of consequence in the Asian security region will flow from Sino-Indian and then Sino-Japanese relations. Polarization and zero-sum balancing like that during the Cold War appear unlikely. Interaction is likely to be characterized by rivalry and competition, but also cooperation. I think in the context of strengthening a U.S.-centered alliance alignment system in Asia, China can be expected to reach out to other major Asian powers like India, Japan, and Russia, as well as other middle and small powers. China would also seek to strengthen and steer Asian multilateral institutions. The final point in looking forward is that despite the persistence of conflicts, both old and new, Asia is unlikely to experience large-scale war. Force will continue to be relevant in international politics, and there will be military clashes, but these will not escalate to large-scale war. And this leads me to discuss the second part of the topic, the prospects for war and peace in Asia. And here again, I'll begin by looking at the last 60 years and then looking forward. The first point I'd like to make is that post-World War II Asia has been highly conflict-ridden. And let me, and I've collected some data here to, because very often people talk about this issue without reference to data. So what I've done is to compile some data from the correlates of war, the Uppsala database, the Heidelberg database, and this is the book actually I'm writing, so what explains war peace. Okay, from post-1945 to 2010, there have been 68 major wars in Asia. 15 of them are interstate wars, 21 intrastate wars over political system and national identity, 26 interstate wars between the state and minority communities, among minority communities, and 6 extrastate wars. These are wars against free trading colonial powers in the early period. And minor wars and militarized disputes, some definition is in order. Major war, the conventional definition is 1,000 battle deaths. That's the conventional definition, and I've used that. Minor wars are between 25 to 1,000. And military disputes, militarized disputes, military clashes are 0 to 25 with armed forces. So there have been 23 minor wars and 24 militarized disputes during this period. Battle deaths, there have been 2 million interstate, 1.9 million within state, and 0.4 million in extra-state wars. And this, of course, doesn't include the civilian deaths. Conflict casualties, I've just given some examples here. During the uprising in East Pakistan, then now Bangladesh, 1.5 million people died. And during the Cultural Revolution, a million people died. And policy failures, I'm not sure this can be really called policy failures, but under Pol Pot, 1.7 million people were killed in Cambodia. And during the Great Leap Forward in China, 20 to 40 million people died. So, and this is not a full account. So there have been a tremendous number of, and the wars do not include the battle deaths. So there have been a large number of interstate wars, but if you look at this data here, there has also been a substantial decline in interstate wars. From 1945 to 1979, 1980, one sees a dramatic increase in the number of interstate wars. But from 79 onwards, there has been a dramatic decline. There have actually only been 2 interstate wars since the Chinese attack on Vietnam in 1979. There was a war in 1987 between China and Vietnam, but that was really a continuation of the earlier war between troops stationed on the border. It was not a new war, so to speak. And then in 1999, between India and Pakistan, over the Kargil incident. So there has been a dramatic decline. Minor wars as well, there has been a dramatic decline. And if you look at the war deaths in Asia, between China and Tibet, that's ended as an interstate war but continues as a domestic issue within China. Between China and Taiwan, there is a stalemate. between China and India, there is a stalemate. China and Vietnam has ended. India-Pakistan stalemate. North Vietnam, South Vietnam has ended. Vietnam, Laos has ended. Vietnam, Cambodia has ended. North Korea, South Korea, there is a stalemate. So you do see a substantial decline in the number of war diets, and several of them, although continuing, are in a stalemate situation. Likewise, having a substantial decline in battle deaths. You know, the 2 million deaths that I mentioned, two wars account for most of them. One is the Korean War, which is almost 1 million casualties, and the other is the Second Indochina War, which accounts for also 1 million. There has been a substantial decline in external power involvement, and there have been no large-scale wars since 1979. Asia has continued to experience a long period of interstate peace. I will not answer the question why 1979, the watershed year. But it's a shift from the interstate war to intrastate war. I think we cannot limit ourselves only to interstate, but also have to look at intrastate, because there have been many, many intrastate wars. The situation is more mixed. And intrastate war, you can divide them into two. One, between it's a war over political systems. In the case of Malaysia, we would look at the Malayan Emergency, 48 to 60, where there was a challenge to the type of political system. I'm just using that as an illustration, but throughout Asia, there have been numerous conflicts over political systems and national identity. And we see that peaking in the early period from the 40s to the 70s, and there has been a decline following the 70s. But this is not the case with wars over between the state and minority communities. We in fact see an increase. If you look at the graph here, there is in fact an increase in wars, both major and minor, between the state and minority communities. So if you look at all these conflicts between states and over political systems and between state and minority communities, one can easily explain these wars by the process of state making, not so much in terms of distribution of power, which is the primary factor that people deploy for analysis. So how does one explain the high number of inter- and intrastate wars in the first three decades after World War II and the substantial decline in interstate and intrastate wars over political systems, but not a corresponding decline in the war between the state and minority communities? Further, how does one explain the persistence of the three intractable conflicts in Asia on the Korean Peninsula, across the Taiwan Strait, and over Kashmir? These conflicts have persisted for more than 50 years. They are not simply, I mean, the questions I raise are not simply academic questions. They have very important policy relevance as well. Most Israeli scholars and official analysts focus on the distribution of power when they look at these conflicts. But as I pointed out earlier in the opening statement, I think state making is a much better variable in terms of looking at the outbreak of these wars and why these kind of conflicts persist. And let me just do one example here by looking at the Taiwan conflict. The Taiwan conflict has its origins in the conflict between the Chinese Communist Party and the KMT over who is the rightful ruler of China. So it goes way back to the 20s, 30s, and 40s, the Civil War in China. The conflict then transformed into over the status of Taiwan, whether Taiwan is a separate and sovereign state. And here, of course, China claims that Taiwan is a part of China and considers it an issue of sovereignty. Although if you look at the impact of the Cold War did not cause this conflict. This conflict came out of the civil war between the CCP and the KMT. The Cold War entrenched the conflict, in some ways prolonged the conflict, but did not cause the conflict. The Cold War terminated, but this conflict continues. So the distribution of power and the global system really do not explain the origins, development, and resolution. The resolution of this conflict across the Taiwan Strait hinges on both in Beijing and in Taipei in terms of how they conceive the status of Taiwan and what is the relationship between Taiwan to mainland China. that is a function of state making. It's not a function really of the distribution of power. And I can advance a similar explanation for the conflict across on the Korean peninsula as well as for the dispute between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. And if there's any interest, I can pursue that during question time. But I think the important point is, why did Asia explain conflict in the first three decades, and why has there been a transformation to peace? And peace here I define as absence of war. I mean, the definition of peace is a controversial one. Minimum definition is the absence of war. And then there is just peace and positive peace and all of that. I'm not getting to that. I'm just getting to the minimum definition of peace, the absence of war. Why has there been a dramatic decline in war? And even those dyads that persist, they have been in a stalemate situation. They have not broken up into open hostilities. What explains this transformation? And here I advance the five reasons as to why there has been this transformation. Number one, I think it's advances in state making. States have become less vulnerable to international intervention and conquest. They're better able to defend themselves, and they've created an international normative structure which in fact makes the forcible change of boundaries and so forth much more costly and much more difficult. Second, I think it's a change in political leadership that emphasizes economic growth and international stability as vital to domestic political domination and legitimacy. This is crucial. I think most countries, you know, we used to talk about comprehensive security and resilience and all of that in the 70s and 80s and 90s in Southeast Asia. And that's very meaningful. You know, people used to look at it somewhat skeptically. But basically, it is an illustration that the concentration and focus is inwards. You know, we are still in the process of making states and making nations, and people don't want any interference from outside. And that also explains the norms that have developed in terms of ASEAN cooperation and so forth. So I think the whole process of state making in terms of making states stronger, less vulnerable, as well as the inward focus and development of political legitimacy within the country, which is absolutely crucial. Third reason is, I think, growing economic interdependence, which increases the cost of using force in an offensive manner. And here I just want to draw your attention to the China's attempted intimidation of Taiwan in 1995-96 and what the cost of that was for China. Why, in fact, these conflicts cannot be resolved through the application of force. Fourth, I think, is the growing legitimacy and stabilization of the political map of Asia. If we look back from 1945 and see how has the Asian political map altered, how many new countries and how many countries have disappeared from the political map. From the political map, disappearance was South Vietnam. I'm not sure who else has disappeared from the political map. New countries would be Singapore. Maybe one can argue North Vietnam and South Vietnam would disappear, and Vietnam was a new country on the scene. Timor-Leste is a new country. So the political map has not altered very substantially compared to Eastern Europe and elsewhere. So there is a legitimacy of the political map, and increasingly the normative structure argues against the use of force in terms of for imperial domination or for conquest. And finally, I think the military technology favors defense and deterrence. This is quite crucial. I think the role of force has altered significantly, and it's really important in denial, defense, and deterrence rather than in offense and conquest. The transition to peace in Asia occurred well before the termination of the Cold War. The termination of the Cold War was in the late 80s and early 90s. But the transition to peace, the reduction in the number of interstate wars occurred in the early 80s onwards. So I think, again, it's difficult to explain this in terms of distribution of power at the global level. Hugh White, again, I'm sorry to keep referring to him, but this is his most recent book, and I was visiting in Australia and New Zealand, and he was cited so frequently. But there are others who are along similar lines, so he argues that peace in Asia is a function of American supremacy post Vietnam. But this is actually factually incorrect. If you look at, you know, where the American withdrawal from South Vietnam, North invaded South and unified the country by force. And then Vietnam invaded and occupied Cambodia for about 10 years. China attacked Vietnam. Both South Korea and Taiwan pursued, had secret nuclear weapons programs because they had doubted American security commitment to them. So I think it would be difficult to argue that peace in Asia is a function of either the American primacy or the termination of the Cold War. It precedes both these, and it's dependent on variables that I've alluded to earlier. To bring this presentation to a conclusion, the question is, will this peace continue? Or will Asia become more conflict-prone? Is major war now again thinkable in Asia? This is sort of looking forward. And I've already referred to people who thought along these lines earlier. And now, as I mentioned, the group of people who are beginning to sound this argument again in relation to Asia. And basically, the reason for making this statement is the change in the distribution of power, the anticipated change in the distribution of power, and how this will bring about conflict between the rising power and the dominant power. But my argument is that changes in the distribution of power alone cannot be the sole basis for making assertions of war and peace. Power has to be linked to values, interests, and purpose. Only when values, interests, and purposes clash in a fundamental manner, and only if states believe that use of force can resolve such clash in their favor, then they will seek the force option. So there's sort of two steps here. One, there must be fundamental differences and disputes. And second, there must be the belief that resort to violence and war will in fact achieve or resolve these fundamental differences. And I think in an age of nuclear weapons, it's hardly likely that U.S. or China will resort to resolve the differences through the use of force. This is important. Rather than simply assert that the distribution of power change is going to bring about war, one has to look at what are the political purposes for which countries may go to war, and whether in fact war will serve that purpose. War is a continuation of politics, as Clausewitz told us many years ago, decades ago, centuries ago. So I think the key question to ask is, those who argue the cause for war and instability arising from China's rise must fill out the causal chain. Is China a revisionist power? What revisions does it seek? Can this be accommodated or adjusted peacefully? Under what conditions might this lead to war? I think you have to answer all these questions before simply asserting that the rise of China will lead to conflict and war. I would argue that the offensive use of force has become highly costly and unlikely. And here I want to advance a controversial proposition, and this comes out of a book on nuclear weapons and security. There are many people, I'm sure some in the audience, who view nuclear weapons as dangerous and weapons that should be abolished altogether, and I do not dispute that. But I think in the current context, these weapons serve a stabilizing function. If you ask the Chinese do away with the nuclear weapon capability, the immediate response would be, what do we do with this immense American military might? You know, nuclear weapons in a way is a poor man's deterrence against strong. And this is a chain reaction all the way down. I just cited China, but it can be equally well applied to India, to Pakistan, to North Korea, and so forth, and to Russia too. Today Russia really sees nuclear weapons as very crucial to its security and stability. But my key point here is that the role of force has changed. Defense and deterrence are the key roles, and I don't think this technology of force is going to alter very rapidly. Other factors that argue against large-scale war, one I think is the continuation of state-making and the concern with internal political domination and legitimacy and stability. That is going to be, whether it's China, India, or many other countries, internal stability, internal legitimacy, concern with that is going to be crucial. And for that, they value international stability. Again, the focus on economic growth and the need for international stability is another variable. The legitimacy of the Asian political map, which I've referred to, the dominance of defense and deterrence, in the absence of fundamental disputes. So all of this, I think, and it just looks like a grab bag, a multi-factorial, multivariable analysis and explanation. But I want to emphasize that you can sort of boil all of this down to the role of force, if you need be. But basically, my explanation is sort of taps into classical realism, defensive realism, commercial liberalism, institutional liberalism, but all of them packaged in this constructivist argument of state making. So that, in a nutshell, and my expectation to conclude is that major war is unlikely, but this does not preclude limited wars, minor wars, or military clashes in the context of state making. I think that will happen. Peace defined as the absence of major war is likely to be durable. Pending the emergence of fundamental political disputes, breakdown of the global economy, or fundamental change in the technology of war. If these things do in fact come about, then I think it's very possible to think of those, becomes thinkable. But simply based on the changing distribution of power, I would not accept the argument that it would lead to instability and war. With that, let me close and take any questions that you may have.